There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The big question today is, who was the real Robin Williams?
The big question.
Dave Itzkoff is a New York Times reporter, and he's written what many are calling the definitive biography of Robin Williams. It's simply called Robin. And our guest reviewer for the next half hour is the wonderful Georgie Bradley. Welcome to the show, Georgie.
Thank you so much for having me.
She is the deputy editor of Emirates Woman. Now, before the news, I asked if you knew which movie starring Robin Williams this line is from. We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. Congratulations to Rachel, who got that text in. It is, of course, from the Dead Poets Society. Have a listen to this.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world. I have a little secret for you. Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. And medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
Robin Williams as John Keating there in Dead Poets Society. Robin Williams is who we're talking about today because we are reviewing Robin by Dave Itzkoff, what is being called as the latest definitive biography of the late entertainer. And we've got Georgie Bradley here in the studio telling us a little bit about it. So, I mean, how did Dave Itzkoff end up writing this biography? How did this come about?
So what happened was, he was and still is a culture reporter for the New York Times. And when Robin Williams was on his, what was not known then, but turned out to be his last comedy boom, he was doing Weapons of Self-Destruction. Mm-hmm. And Dave went on the road with him for material for a piece that he was writing. I think it was like a profile feature. And then after he died, he had all this sort of material to work with, and then he went beyond that friendship he had with Robin. He went to his immediate family, and then they sort of sent him off to other people because Dave had a really good relationship with him. They kind of had this one-on-one, very unusual thing with a journalist and someone of that kind of meteoric sort of fame, and that kind of gave rise to this book.
So he had a bit of a head start, Dave Itzkoff. I mean, he already knew a lot about Robin Williams and had his trust and the trust of his family. Because it is a remarkably up close and personal
account.
Oh
yeah, he goes into granular detail for sure, yeah.
So what do you now know about Robin Williams that you didn't know before?
I think the thing is, with someone like Robin Williams, even though he gave so much of himself to the world, it's still just the tip of the iceberg. Someone who is so extroverted and operating on so many cylinders, there's always a story beneath that surface. So I think we really got to grips with this book in how insecure he was as a person and how much he wanted validation and affirmation from people who had his respect all his career, but he constantly wanted to produce and produce. There's a really poignant line where he says in the book, I think he said it to his last wife, Susan, he said, "You're only as good as your last performance." So you could tell that as much as he had carved out this incredible career over so many years, he felt like he had to keep giving and keep giving and be as relevant as possible.
That's an expression that exists, I think, in many industries. You're only as good as your last book, or as your last performance, or as your last song. Mm. But I think that, I mean, the sense I got from reading Robin was that he took that a lot more literally and was a lot more affected by that than most people, and was never satisfied with what he produced.
No. I mean, when you are at that kind of summit of superstardom, you've got the weight of expectation constantly to maintain. So I think he set himself, and also if you are that high, imagine that fall, you know? So I think he was very concerned about always entertaining.
Do you like Robin Williams and his work, and how do you feel differently about it now?
So here's the thing. I don't think anybody who hasn't seen everything that he's done shouldn't read it. You should read it if you are interested in someone who was perceived as this sad clown, right? Because he was... So for me, one of the main things that I loved about him was his sort of ability to ad-lib and be super... improvisational. And I love that as well because I have a theatre background and I was very much concerned with his sort of 90s period of films. So Mrs. Doubtfire, Jack, Hook. And actually these are the films which the book says that were his, the lauded ones, the ones that critics didn't really take to. And I think what I've learned from it is that he was an incredibly gentle soul and he had a huge amount of humanity. And I love that because there was a lot more to that noise that he put out there for people to hear. You know, he was deeply sensitive, but also deeply troubled as well. I mean, look at the way his life ended.
I think, yeah, deeply sensitive and deeply troubled summed it up quite well. And I also have a bit of a theatre background as well. And some of the reports about his acting rather than his stand-up, I found slightly... grating, and I think it would have been irritating for certain people to be working with him when he was so focused on himself. And I mean, for me, theatre is the ultimate team sport, and he didn't always seem to be a team player.
Yeah, I mean, he did want to hog the limelight, you know. And actually, what I found interesting in this was how insecure he was when other kind of new crop on the comedy circuit came in. So for example, he was really maybe not outwardly threatened, but sort of in his personal life, he would often talk about how, you know, Jim Carrey being on the scene, who's also very, very physical. I think they're very different comedically, but you can see that they share the same sort of techniques and that slapstick, and also Eddie Murphy.
Exactly.
So I found that very, very interesting. But then of course you would be a bit not sensitive, but just sort of like, this is my territory, like, let me be me and you do you. I think he felt that anyone who had an ascent into comedy meant that he would sort of descend, but absolutely not. I mean, there was a space for everybody, but I think because he was so loud, everybody saw and heard him and he didn't want anybody to kind of clip his wings.
A zero-sum game, I think, is how he describes it in the book. You know, if someone else is doing well, then he can't be doing well. And I found the those two in particular quite stark, and particularly the Jim Carrey example, because for me, they have a huge amount of similarities. I mean, they're both highly, highly energetic and very... physically and verbally dexterous. They can do a lot of mimicry. They're very, very gifted.
Yeah, and they've also been called the funniest people on TV. So when you share that title, it's like, well,
you can't share that title.
Exactly.
I think that's the exact point. But no, he was, I think, also very threatened by Eddie Murphy, and particularly Eddie Murphy's almost instant success with Trading Places and then with coming to America in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, Robin Williams was having serious concerns about some of his films, some of which were successful, none of which were particularly well received by the critics, but a number of which were the opposite of successful.
I mean, if you were to go into IMDb, a lot of the films that we hold dear in our hearts, especially as children, they're only about 6.2 on IMDb. So, I mean, if you go by those numbers, they're not the best. But at the same time, for me, Hook was one of my absolute favourites, but it wasn't received by the critics well at all. They called it quite hammy, quite schmaltzy and sentimental. But I don't know, as a child, I thought it was the best thing ever, you know?
I still haven't seen Hook.
No.
No, I still haven't seen it.
How is that?
Just, well, one of those things.
I have seen it. I'm afraid to say I'm completely at the other end of the spectrum from you on it. I think even as a child, I didn't like it. And I think the reason I didn't like it was Robin Williams. I felt...
Really?
Yeah, I felt that the film, like a lot of his films, was just a vessel to put him out there in a thinly veiled approximation of himself.
Sure. I mean, a lot of the directors have said that... they really had to rein him in on a lot of sets because he had this thing where he had to ad lib. And I guess that's very sort of self-serving as well. And does that really keep within the kind of script lines? Probably not. That's the whole point of ad libbing. But he did it without any permission because he felt like he could.
Yeah.
I don't think it's entirely self-serving, though, when you do that. I think it also, if there's a chance that it makes the piece better, then you should always do that.
Jonathan's
getting annoyed now.
I like to stick to the script. And I mean, I think it's a very fine line. And
don't forget, though, his background is in stand-up comedy. So he's used to receiving instant applause and that kind of instant sort of entertainment like factor, you know. So I think, you know.
But he still wanted to do theatre as well. I mean, so he dropped out of Juilliard.
Yeah, and that's incredible because I believe they only take 12 students per course, per degree. So obviously you've got to be the cream of the crop. So he showed some sort of dramatic mettle to be there. But then I think he was quite flighty as well. So he wanted to do what he wanted to do. And if that wasn't something, I think he wanted to do Shakespeare and all these sort of seen as harder, more sophisticated acting techniques. But he also just wanted to be a goofball as well. I think he really wanted to prove that he could do a little bit of everything. But his main sort of creative muscle was comedy.
I got slightly confused by that because that section of the book, there was a kind of, wasn't it a legend that he left because there was nothing more that they could teach him, but that wasn't the truth. The truth was that he wasn't really getting anything out of it.
Yeah, I think it remained and remains a moot point. It depends who you ask. I mean, I think the director of Juilliard at the time said that they parted company on fairly decent terms. I think it just became clear that he wasn't in the right place.
Now, we were talking about the fact that Robin Williams, you know, while he appeared this wonderful, zany man on stage, it wasn't necessarily who he really was underneath.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we've got a little clip now, which we think highlights this quite nicely about how Robin Williams was one to wear a mask. So have a little listen to this.
I used to do a thing about that too, about called Celebrity, about this man signing autographs with a big smile, goes home and takes off like...
And it's a monster. But
yeah, it's like a whole bizarre thing, because sometimes maintaining that is a very scary thing. Yeah, it's true. You said about sometimes being on, that people want you to be a certain way, and sometimes you can't help but be depressed, or, you know, just the nature of being.
Goodness me, sometimes you can't help being depressed, just the nature of being. Oh, that's a bit of a heavy note to finish on. Georgie.
Yeah, you see, he was still really honest. I mean, that's the thing.
Was he? Well, always honest?
Honest in a way that still protected him, I think. So he could answer questions with a kind of constructed sort of way so that it wouldn't...
I mean, that feeling, that underlying feeling was clearly, I mean, that was from years and years ago. That was clearly always there. So it's not like that ever clearly, you know, went away.
So where did this all come from, Georgie? Why was he the person he was?
Why was he the person who became a depressive?
Why was he, yes, why was he, how did he become Robin Williams?
So this is the interesting thing. A lot of comedians have this sort of rags to riches story, but actually I think he had the reverse. Mm-hmm. He had a riches to rags story, at least while he was still making it as a comedian, because his father was an executive for Ford. His mother was this Southern Belle socialite. They were moving from one place to another in these really posh suburbs in mansions, but he was still quite lonely, very popular at school, as the biography talks about, but he still had this nomadic lifestyle. So no matter how many friendships you forge, you're still having to constantly uproot. So he had this kind of these gaps in his life, and he filled it with a lot of humor and comedy. And he started out in LA, and then that went over across the whole state and then the world, comedy and then to film. And I think anyone who is on the road, an artist who kind of ruminates in their head all the time, you're going to have some gaps, I think. And he had the kind of the family around him. He had first wife, second wife, kids and everything. But, you know, you never really know what goes on beyond that noise.
So the book... accounted for the phenomenon of Robin Williams in a couple of ways, I thought. One was his parents, as you say, this sort of effusive, adoring mother who couldn't be kinder to him and couldn't get enough of him, and a very stern, removed, busy father who was often elsewhere.
And who told him, great that you're going to go into acting, but have a backup profession like welding.
Exactly, exactly. So the book claimed that his parents were partly to, not to blame, but accounted for,
for
his personality. But also, as you say, his early life and the fact that he was constantly relocating. And if you go somewhere new frequently, then that shapes your personality. I mean, so his parents and his early life, is that it? Is that, do you buy that?
Well, no, I mean, it's a lifetime worth of experiences, highs and lows, the peaks and troughs of his career. I think he just really wanted to be taken seriously, and he wanted to work, he wanted to entertain. And if you're setting out to operate on all cylinders like that, you know, there's gonna be some come downs as well that come with that, because you really set high expectations for yourself and for your experience of this world. So I think, and so it's interesting, after Juilliard, or during Juilliard, he befriended Christopher Reeve, who famously played Superman. And he described him, and this is a really affecting way of looking at it, he was like an untied balloon that had been inflated and immediately released. So I think that really speaks to, and it's very symbolic of, how he was either 100 or 0, and then nothing kind of in between. And going from 0 to 100 was within a matter of seconds, and then, you know, back again. So he was very...
he was very all or nothing.
Very much so. Very, very much so. And I don't think that's very sustainable. So it kind of breeds these underlying problems, which then turned into Lewy body disease, which is a form of Parkinson's as well. And in his latter part of his life, he was really trying to scramble as much money as possible. I mean, he had a divorce to pay. He had a lifestyle to maintain, a new wife who, you know, obviously would want things. And he was getting all these studio films under his belt, which didn't really serve to prove anything in his sort of skills and talent as a performer. But it was mainly money jobs. But he also was very honest about that, saying, you know, I've got to do these things. He had a nice raft of serious roles in Dead Poets Society, Good Will Hunting. But you know what? And this happens with a lot of actors. After they get that crowning achievement of the Oscar, it kind of does go downhill, because how do you maintain that? You know, especially with new people coming in all the time, and, you know, having exercised his creative muscles over, what, 40 years plus? I mean, that's no mean feat.
So tell us about some of the films he's made, some of the successful ones, some of the less successful ones, and some of your favourites.
So this is a funny thing. Like I said earlier, I am very much preoccupied with the 90s version. Well, not 90 version, but the 90s Robin Williams. And that's partly because of my age. I've actually never seen Mork and Mindy, which was kind of his first ascent into stardom. Have you guys seen it?
I've seen it, but I've seen not at the time.
I've seen clips of it, hence the nano.
Yeah, see, it's not really my... See, I didn't even pick up on that. I've definitely seen sort of bits and pieces of it on YouTube when I've watched him on talk show hosts, but I never really got into it because it's not really my genre of choice. But I think Mork and Mindy really set the way for him to be taken for what he was, this kind of grand, prolific entertainer. And then he had Dead Poets Society, Good Morning Vietnam, where people saw a different light to him, maybe kind of his sort of Juilliard sort of training behind him. And then Hook, Mrs. Doubtfire, and then Jack, which, you know, in the break we're saying how Jack is one of my favourite films by him. I know you kind of gave me a nice side eye to that, because it was completely hammered by the critics. But I think, first of all, Jack is about a boy who's born with a disease whereby he has this accelerated rate of growth. So by the time he's 10, he looks like he's 40. And then by the time he's 18, he looks like he's, you know, ready to go. And what I liked about it was he was, you know, this adult body with this really vulnerable and sweet outlook of on life, like, you know, the way a 10-year-old does. And I just found it really endearing and touching. And in his valedictorian speech at the graduation ceremony in the film, he talks about the preciousness of life, which is quite piercing.
I've seen that speech go around, even though I haven't seen the film. That's kind of doing the rounds on Facebook at the moment.
So isn't that film just a vessel for Robin Williams to be himself? I mean, is that not a lot like
probably
the actual Robin Williams?
Yeah.
I mean, an adult with a very childlike and sensitive psyche.
Yeah, well, maybe that's why I took to it, because you can kind of see the true sort of vulnerabilities of this man in the character, but then, you know, you can
really... Is that something you want? Do you want to see the actor behind the character when you're watching a film?
If it's Robin Williams, I do.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's a pretty fascinating guy. Well, yeah. Was, posthumously, yeah.
So how does his, and we talked a bit about Mork and Mindy and some of the things he did in the 90s, does this stuff date well?
So, I mean, for me, the films that I love, I will still love and I will always love. But those then, I don't know. I mean, I think that's one of his main preoccupations, actually. When he was, when the early noughties kind of happened, he was really concerned about still being relevant and making sure that his content, especially comedically, they still had life in them. But actually, I don't think they did, even though he was very politically engaged and very, very well read, as it turned out. But I don't know, that kind of earlier stuff, I think they're kind of archived as they happened. They're part of his career, but I don't think he's definitely known for that. I think he's known as a kind of collective, as a comedian, as an actor.
He's also very politically incorrect, or was very politically incorrect as well. And some of his stand-up from the 80s or so I think it would be almost unpalatable to the modern audience.
So I was just about to come on to that. I think now in a post-Me Too world, there would have been a lot of shenanigans that would have been called into questions, especially from his Mork and Mindy days. In the book, it talks about how he was sort of a little bit loose, very physical about, you know...
Yeah, no, I mean, it talks about grabbing female co-stars and inverted commas, goosing them. I mean, you know, and it's kind of brushed over, and they all say, oh, you know, Robin could get away with it. But I'm not sure Robin could get away with it. If he was still alive, I suspect he might be the subject of a campaign.
Mm. One thing I'd like to return to is, because we're talking about this biography by Dave Itzkoff, as I'm not a particular fan of biographies, but I still found that there were bits in this that were very interesting, but I had to kind of jump ahead and dip in and out. I mean, do you usually read biographies? Is this?
No, I don't. I hardly ever read biographies.
And how did you find this?
So I have the app Goodreads, and it's kind of like a virtual library where you can find your next best read, as they put it. And it came up on my feed, and I thought, well, this looks good. And I mean, I know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I really liked the cover of it, where he's got his hand over his mouth as if he's about to tell a secret. And I thought, ooh, I want to find out a lot more, because I kind of felt like we did know all there was to know about him, but you never really know, because at the end of the day, in the public eye, you construct a very, very particular image of yourself.
I like your interpretation of that, by the way. His hand is over his mouth, so, you know, because he's about to tell a secret. For me, it's that he's trying to shut himself up, that he's always talking, and that hand is sort of grasping over his mouth to stop Robin Williams coming out.
Or maybe because, you know, he's no longer with us, we've got someone else who's doing that for us. So it's a very different perspective, because, you know, when you self-reflect, it's very different to the kind of outside-in perspective. So, yeah. And I think what I love about this biography, and I read it within like 2-3 days, and I don't have a lot of time to do that, and this is, you know,
it's
you're holding
hefty.
It now, Annabelle, it's a nice doorstop of a book, and I didn't even realize how long it was until I finished, and I thought, oh my goodness, it's done. I liked how lively it's written, and how there's so many different access points that I'm thinking, how did you get to these people? How did they even allow you to? Because, you know, this is personal stuff. This is a man's life who's no longer here to continue a conversation or to even verify certain things. So, it's a lot of responsibility.
I think that's what I took out of it more than anything else, is the brilliance of Dave Itzkoff and the brilliance of the book. I mean, it's a masterpiece.
It is.
As not a fan of Robin Williams, I felt crushed at the end of it.
Right?
See, this is incredibly sad.
Isn't it? Because the thing is, the whole time I was reading it, it felt like he'd really brought him back to life, and the energy that was kind of popping off from the pages, I thought, wow, this guy, it's like he's still alive. And then you know what's happening, what's going to happen at least. And then by the time you get to that last chapter, oh my goodness, there was one line where Dave refers to that meme that was circulating on the Academy Awards Instagram, where it was Aladdin hugging the genie. It says, "Genie, you're free. And I honestly, it broke my heart because I thought, God, what kind of life were you escaping? What was going on? And obviously that was at the very end of the book, so you kind of knew, but it's just very, very heartwarming.
We're going to have to wrap up very, very shortly. There's one thing that I would like to leave the conversation with, and that's kind of the last paragraph in the prologue, which I thought was really beautifully written. Dave Itzkoff's biography, Robin, is what I'm reading from. Everyone felt as if they knew him, even if they did not always admire the work he did. Millions of people loved him for his generosity of spirit, his quickness of mind, and the hopefulness he inspired. Some lost their affection for him in later years, as the quality of his work declined, even as they held out hope that he'd find the thing, the project, the character, the spark, that had made him great before. As great as he was when he first burst into the cultural consciousness, and when he was gone, we all wished we'd had him just a little bit longer. I thought that, you know, that just gives you an idea as to how well David Itzkoff's writing is in this biography. Thank you so much, Georgie, for coming on the show to talk about
it.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.